We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, progressive talk radio from the University of Delaware.
I'm Bill Humphrey. Thanks for listening to the Arsenal for Democracy from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, brought to you by the University of Delaware and the Newark community. If you're listening live online as we record, it is July 5th, 2012. We usually live stream and record the show every Thursday evening at 7:30 p.m. Eastern at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio. The server is down temporarily. Hopefully we'll have it fixed in time for tomorrow. We re-air on 91.3 FM locally and at WVUD.org on Fridays at 4 p.m. Eastern. And the show will be available for download on iTunes and other locations after that. I'm coming to you live from the WVUD studios in Newark, Delaware. Beaming in from the Beltway is my co-host, Anna, a moderator at Oh No, They Didn't Political. Hey, Anna.
How are you?
I am doing okay. As usual, a reminder that the views expressed on this program are ours alone and do not represent the views of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or anyone else. And we have quite a few interesting stories to get into this week, so why don't we get down to that? The first thing that I wanted to discuss was this opinion piece in the New York Times by Kurt Anderson, who's a novelist and a writer or has formerly written for publications like The New Yorker and such as a columnist. And he wrote a column called The Downside of Liberty, and we were discussing this before the show. You had some issues with it, but the main thesis, as I understood it, and this was printed on July 3rd, the main thesis was basically that in the late 1960s, there was this push for individual freedom, cultural freedom. I called it cultural libertarianism, sort of the, you know, well, we should all be free to do whatever we want to do. And
laissez-faire.
Yeah, but it's a cultural laissez-faire. So, you know, everyone should have the right to do whatever they want as long as it doesn't hurt anyone else. And, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And his sort of point about this was that which definitely had some benefits to it. You know, that there were things, there were good things that came out of that, certainly. But one of the downsides was that sort of focus on individualism over everything else, basically helped push the economic individualism that we see today, which is a polite way of saying economic selfishness, and that thesis essentially being that the baby boomers who are retiring today and are generally a lot of the same people who were involved in that cultural revolution in the 1960s, that their reluctance, which we've talked about on previous episodes, so you can refer back to those for more in-depth discussion, but that those people they were pushing for individualism and individual freedom, and now they're extending that logically to economic freedom, that they shouldn't be taxed more, that they deserve Social Security, but, you know, doesn't matter if anyone else gets it, that selfishness that we've talked about before. Now, you had some issues with his sort of folksy justification of citing, you know, some golden age that probably never was in middle America in the, you know, 50s and 60s.
I guess I felt that there were a lot of things that I found valid about his discussion. I felt that he was right in the timing, in that this is sort of when the two things started to happen, but he doesn't make a good argument for them happening anything else than anything other than parallel to each other. And he starts off by saying that the revolution dreamed up in the 60s has been mostly won. And he says women's rights, gay rights, black president, ecology, sex, drugs, rock and roll. And I guess I found that sort of dismissive. Like, we have a black president now, everything's fine, has been sort of thrown around as a joke for people who pretend that we're post-racial. But he really does seem to just gloss over what we were fighting for. I say we, I mean people that are minorities, women, things like that. Obviously, I was not there. What we were fighting for, and then he later on, let me see if I can pull it up as exactly, because I don't want to misquote him. Let's see. A kind of tacit grand bargain was forged between the counterculture and the establishment, between the forever young and the moneyed. And what he says afterwards is that going forward, the youthful masses of every age would be permitted, as never before, to indulge their self-expressive and hedonistic impulses, which, again, I think is mischaracterizing what the 60s was about. And what there obviously were hippies that were just in it for the drugs and fun, but those weren't the people that were fighting for the rights that he mentions earlier. Really, they're not the same people. But capitalists, in return, would be unshackled as well, free to indulge their own animal spirits with fewer and fewer fetters in the forms of regulation, taxes, or social opprobrium, which I felt was a great use of that word. But at the same time, again, it sort of mischaracterizes the people that were fighting for equal rights of various kinds, and for women's rights, and, as he never mentions, fighting to never have war again, basically. And it's kind of funny that he says we basically got everything we want while we're embroiled in several wars and many wars. And these paragraphs sort of imply that the people that were fighting for these rights are somehow responsible. There was a tacit agreement. Like, we knew that by fighting for what we wanted, we were also going to be conceding this. And I found that very strange, when I don't think people were even aware that maybe this could lead to that. And I still don't see his argument for why it did.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
I definitely thought that you raised a lot of good points and problems with the column. I thought, though, that it was a very good jumping off point for kind of having a discussion about the relationship between, you know, cultural libertarianism and economic libertarianism.
Yes, and I strongly agree with your characterization of social libertarianism. And again, I think that's part of what is the problem with this article, is he discusses the social libertarianism. Later he says that, what is it? If it feels good, do it, whether that means smoking weed and watching porn and never wearing a necktie, retiring at 50 with a six-figure public pension. And he's, again, sort of drawing this conclusion from the hippie with no job that smokes weed and the person that is very conservative and full of money. And, again, he's sort of discussing the part where we wanted freedoms but not equality. So, again, like the freedom to do things but also not the equality for, say, equal pay, as women were fighting for, and other things that we wanted out of the government.
Yeah. Now, I kind of had a couple thoughts about that. The first thing that I thought of was that the overall change in attitudes, in order to change societal attitudes and allow the permissiveness on those things that weren't rights, you know, mm-hmm. not talking about civil rights, not talking about equal pay, but basically the you know, doing a lot of drugs and that kind of thing, which technically, you know, a lot of them are they're not allowed, but in terms of, you know, social acceptability, some of those things are more socially acceptable, that in order to have that happen, you know, societal attitudes and views had to change, and the side effect of the views changing in favor of, you know, this individual liberty and freedoms translated into individual rights as well. You know, that's a kind of a tenuous argument, but I think you could kind of make the case that there is a relationship there.
I think you could, but I think the fact that he constantly glosses over the more important parts of what we were fighting for and anything that doesn't go with his argument, like the fact that, again, in the 60s, a lot of what people were fighting for was to not be fighting internationally anymore, and he never sort of covers that. That mm-hmm. he never goes into, he seems to gloss over and have a poor understanding or not want to go into much detail of what the people in the 60s were actually fighting for. And for that reason, the fact that he's sort of insinuating blame towards them, maybe, makes me a little leery. Because mm-hmm. again, I think he kind of paints them, again, he mentions like porn and smoking weed and not wearing a necktie. And it's like, I don't think that was really what it was about. That's not really what people were fighting for the most part.
Yeah, I definitely felt like the article relied a lot on sort of sweeping stereotyped conceptions of the period.
Yeah, and I wish he would have gone more into his time when he was living in Omaha, I believe it was.
Yeah.
Because he sort of mentions the way he thinks that things wouldn't have worked then, but he doesn't like if somebody had been as they are now and sort of paying themselves more, you know, 200 or 400 times what they paid their employees, that wouldn't have gone over well. But I don't see any numbers about it. I don't even see like a story about it from his childhood.
Yeah, no, it's just kind sort of an intimation of what he doesn't think would have worked. His gut sense. Yeah, I didn't think this was terribly well thought out. However, one thing that this definitely did make me think about was that relationship between, you know, because he talks about in this article the tension between individualism and, I guess it's not, you know, it's not equality of outcomes, it's equality of opportunities, and it's this, you know, helping each other kind of culture he refers to as the common weal, you know, it's the common good, essentially, that there's been this really long tension. And this is backed up in all kinds of political science and history research, that there's been this really long standing tension since the colonists arrived in the United States between the value of individualism versus the value of sort of a more communitarian common good approach. And this ties in with some of my research that I had been doing in the spring in my research on American dream rhetoric in the presidential nomination acceptance speeches. And John Kingdon, who's a political historian, wrote this book. I think it was published in like 1999, called America the Unusual. And he basically synthesized and boiled down all the existing theories into that dichotomy of individualism versus equality of opportunity. We've been very clear consistently, both, you know, ends of the political spectrum in terms of mainstream politics have been very clear that it's not about equality of outcome, you know, which is the more socialist version. But the equality of opportunity is in theory supposed to be a key value. But the problem is, you know, you can't just magically make equality of opportunity. There are going to have to be corrective measures taken at some point, and then that starts running into trouble with the individualism. And so, you know, I think that also kind of contradicts his thesis, because, you know, something like the Equal Rights Amendment or equal pay, that those fights that kind of really started getting steam in the late 1960s, early 1970s, those things were about that equality of opportunity issue, not the individualism issue, because individualism would be like, you know, every woman for herself, essentially, whereas this is about an equality of opportunity for a whole group. But it is true that there has been this tension for a really long time, because, you know, you had some of the early colonists, because there were a whole bunch of different colonies. I mean, obviously there were, you know, the famous 13, but there are actually more colonies than that, and not even all of them were British initially. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even in what's now Massachusetts, you had at least two colonies, major colonies, like side by side at one point. And so you'd have, you know, some of those people, you know, like the Pilgrims, that was a very communitarian type of thing, you know, that we're either all going to sink or swim. Yeah. Or we're going to rise as one. And that was a very common good communitarian oriented type approach. But there were other colonies, like, for example, the Virginia colony tended to be founded by these sort of speculator people looking for gold. They were all about, you know, that they were individually going to succeed. And interestingly, you know, the Pilgrims came pretty close to getting wiped out, but they managed to keep it together enough to not die completely with a lot of help from the local indigenous population. Whereas the Jamestown colony, which was basically a bunch of, you know, venture capitalist types, they basically ended up eating each other because they didn't work together at all, and they couldn't. Most of them had no skills necessary for the survival of the colony, et cetera. That this has been a tension, that there's been different strands the whole time in United States history between the people who wanted to have that more individualistic approach and the people who wanted to have more of a focus on the equality of opportunity. And again, it's opportunity, not outcome. And the thing is, you know, when you're looking at things like healthcare, looking at things like education, general social welfare type programs, if you look around the world, you'll usually hear examples like, you know, that the you know, the Scandinavian countries or the Baltic countries or something like that, you know, that they, or South Korea, that they have higher education rates. And you hear all about the healthcare systems of, you know, Canada and Scandinavian countries like Denmark and Sweden and Norway. But the thing that is often left out is that those are very homogenous populations. You know, it's a lot easier to teach or provide healthcare for a population. Well, in terms of education, just it's literally easier to teach a group of people who are all pretty much the same than a whole bunch of different people from different backgrounds. But
especially
in terms
if
of
language barriers are never an issue,
right? But in terms of political problems, you know, with something like healthcare or a general social welfare state, if you have a population that's like 95% white, you know, and everyone looks like you, everyone's from the same background, they all speak the same language, that's going to be politically a lot easier than, because humans kind of naturally divide into groups, and sometimes
it's sadly going to be an easier sell.
Sometimes they're not the most altruistic, shall we say. So, you know, the a lot of times there's this sense, and this has been a recent problem as immigrants move into Denmark and Norway, that you have these clashes where suddenly people who have previously been very willing to support a social welfare state are not as likely to support a social welfare state and such programs anymore. And, you know, that's just kind of a sad reality, is that people are much more comfortable providing stuff, whether it's through the public sector and the government or through charity and that sort of thing. Or helping out their neighbors. If their neighbors look like them and everyone in the population looks like them and is from the same background and speaks the same language, that's always going to be politically easier to do these programs for. The United States has really struggled, especially in recent years, with this resistance to providing services, even really basic services, because there's this portrayal that the non-white, the non-elite populations are somehow leeching or mooching off of the tax-paying white middle class and the white super rich, etc. Obviously,
yeah, the border states, especially Arizona, you can see in the language they have huge fears of this and are kind of obsessed with it. To the point where they're shooting themselves in the foot with a lot of the legislation.
And it used to be that a lot of the resentment. I mean, there's always been some population that's the resented kind of minority one. You know, sometimes it's the Asians with the Exclusion Act. Sometimes it's the Irish, sometimes, you know, and then for a long time, of course, you know, for most of American history, the dominant non-white population was, of course, Black Americans, and there's been so much, I mean, you can't deny that there's been so much tension and really negative history between whites and the former slave population. That's, you know, something we can't wish away. That happened, and you know, now, as you say, the new big group that's emerging really fast is the, you know, Hispanic, and then that introduces the language issue as well. But there's, you know, this. I think that is something that is definitely, I think we should be discussing more, and we're probably not going to, because this country is incompetent at discussing race in a serious and grown up manner. But
I think it would be worth it even to just explore the history of the popularity of welfare and in general sort of safety nets in our country, and how the population has affected the popularity of those.
And also, you know, you can look at like the stereotypes, you know, I think even today, I think most welfare recipients, like a majority, are actually low income white. But the stereotype is almost never the poor white population.
When you think of the words welfare queen, what do you think of?
Right. And so that was kind of a big turning point as well, that I think, you know, I question the laying the blame on the late 60s. It might be partly to blame, but I think a lot of it is the sort of Reagan revolution and all the associated things. Of course. And this is something that he could have mentioned. I think that a lot of the stuff came up as a reaction to what was happening in the 1960s. I mean, you know, it got the Reagan Revolution really got kicked off with the Goldwater Revolution in 1964. And that, you know, very closely linked together the hardcore right-wing economics with, you know, I should say libertarian economics, because right-wing economics could refer to more fascist economics, which is statist. But in terms of this very small government, you know, the government's role should be limited. Any new social welfare program like Medicare or Social Security, that's, you know, leading us to collectivism and communism. You know, these stereotypes. The stereotypes of the welfare queen and things like that, they were popularized during the Reagan era. But they weren't, you know, invented right then. Like, these were things that were bubbling up for a long time, being researched and developed in the wilderness years after the New Deal and during the Johnson administration in the 1960s. I think that the reactionary aspect catalyzed by these processes in the 1960s probably had a much bigger effect. And you know that was a pivotal moment. We're still essentially living in the Reagan mold, if you will, the paradigm, the Reagan paradigm. Steven Skoranek's book, "The Politics Presidents Make," I believe it was called. I hope I'm not mixing up different books and people, but. But I think I got that one right, because I'm just doing this off the top of my head from my own research. He had kind of said that instead of looking at things, you know, in terms of parties and chronologies, we should be looking at sort of these long, you know, sometimes even decades long eras of who kind of set the whole like message, set the debate. And, you know, a lot of that stuff was created during the 1960s in the minority by the hard right Republicans, not the moderate Eisenhower Republicans, but the hard right Republicans that nominated Goldwater in 1964. They ended up coming to power in 1980, and then the Reagan administration, you know, yes, he's been gone for a while, but that really set the tone, and we're still kind of living in that shadow. Not to mythologize him to the extent that the conservatives do now, but just the, you know, in terms of setting the agenda and setting the debate and setting the terms of the discussion and the words and the language used in the discussion, we're still very much in this, you know, Reagan era. And those stereotypes, you know, those, all of that kind of libertarian economic stuff that Goldwater was preaching and that Reagan brought to fruition to some extent, that was tied right in with the states' rights, racist Southern strategy type stuff that was going on at the same time. That, you know, and the Reagan rise, et cetera, was made possible by the first wave of defections by the Southern Democrats, the Dixiecrat types, who wanted to maintain segregation and racist policies, and they defected to the Republicans, giving them enough of a new base to rise to power. And, you know, that stuff, I feel like, has gone hand in hand. And I think I've now completely reversed my position on the original opinion piece, but I think it was a good place to start in terms of a discussion. And I think we do need to, you know, to jump back a little bit. We do need to go and have that discussion, as you said, about what kind of images and stereotypes do we use in terms of discussing social welfare policy.
Or when the popularity of these things declined. Because yeah. When they originally came out, we were a country in dire straits economically as we are now, but we had very different feelings about the strategies that were very similar to the ones that we have now that were going to get us out of it. And that did successfully help us to get through a lot of economic problems.
Can we briefly talk about the city selling ads story? Because I think that relates, you know, we've been talking about the economic libertarianism, the I got mine attitude, the, you know, the resistance to paying taxes any higher, et cetera. So there were a couple of related stories there. So you found this article from the end of June in the New York Times. This was, the headline was, "Your ad here on a fire truck, broke cities sell naming rights." So why don't you talk a little bit about that one?
Basically, cities that are broke, which is happening sadly more and more often, cities that are reaching out as far as possible to try and find funds, are considering things like your ad here on a fire truck, and there's a New York Times article about it saying that they could be, basically, red fire trucks could be turned into billboards.
And this has already been done by some in some locations by various companies. Kentucky Fried Chicken, like, I thought this was Photoshop, but this was an actual photo they had from provided by the KFC Corporation.
Yeah.
They paid for new fire hydrants and manhole covers and potholes, filling potholes in this place in Indiana. And the fire hydrants literally have, like, KFC bucket ad type things wrapped around them. It's the most ridiculous thing. And they had done, like, KFC manhole covers that had, like, ads on them. And there's some towns that have been selling, like bumper ads on police cars for local businesses, or they have, like, fire trucks that, you know, are sponsored. But, you know, this safety message about getting out of the house when it's on fire, brought to you by the such and such group. And there was
Reeboks, one better out of your house.
There was some there was some debate about in some communities about the police. They were like, we don't really feel like we should be putting
they don't want to look like NASCAR drivers, basically.
Well, yeah, they were just like, we should be neutral, and it would be really awkward if we were, you know, called to respond to something at one shopping center and we had the ad for the rival shopping center.
There's a ton that could go wrong with this. I mean, it starts off by making, I mean, in the title it mentions fire trucks. I can't imagine that there would be many companies that would have PR people that would say, yeah, it'll be safe. We can be associated with fires. Can you imagine, like, and cops in general, people have such mixed feelings about them. I'm sure that the...
It just undercuts the seriousness of their job.
Yeah, to say nothing of that, just on the end of, like, from the view of the people that are trying to sell their brand, I can't imagine that they would be 100% sure that they would be viewed as somebody who was supporting the community and paying for needed services, for instance, police officers and fire trucks.
Well,
or would they be associated with the terrible events that the fire trucks and the police cars have to go to?
That's true. Well, okay, so looking at it for a moment from the perspective of the corporations, one idea... from, I think it was Syracuse, New York, had basically, like, there were all these budget cuts, and so they were going to have to cut the rescue helicopter. But they're now hoping to sell ads on the rescue helicopter. I feel like that one, what they're thinking of from that perspective, and I think this is kind of brilliant, it's like, who thinks of these things, is that you know that there's going to be all these TV cameras drawn to the site of wherever they're sending this helicopter, right? Unless it's some random remote mountain thing. But it's kind of like how when you see the helicopters that go by, the news helicopters, of course, advertising the station that they're from. But when you have the rescue helicopter, that's now the subject of the actual television segment. And so now you see this ad. And you're probably like, you kind of consciously tune out the giant, like, McDonald's ad or whatever on the side of the rescue helicopter, but it's still sitting on screen for an extended period of time. Like, I'm thinking about situations where you know, like, this, it wouldn't be so effective on the evening news, you know, when they've cut it down to like a 30-second, 45-second segment. But while it's happening live, when they cut away from the daytime TV and soap operas and stuff, and they just have it circling for like an hour, that is brilliant. You've now got this ad just sitting there on the screen, and, you know, the station's not making any money, but the city's making money, and, you know, it's just sitting there, and people are kind of absorbing it. And thinking about how they want to, you know, buy whatever product. I think that, you know, that's kind of a really creative thing. Do I think they should do that? No, absolutely not. I think that's a terrible idea. But
the same, is it better than, I mean, they mentioned Baltimore had to shut down how many? 3 fire companies?
Yeah, that was the thing that Baltimore was, the city of Baltimore was shutting down multiple fire companies. And they were saying that just, like, selling the rights for fire engines, like fire engine advertising, wasn't even going to pay for keeping one station open.
But let's discuss this, say hypothetically, because this is sadly something that's happening all over the country, as we've been discussing. For these cities that are basically having to shut down everything that makes them work and everything that keeps them safe, obviously you don't want to have KFC filled potholes necessarily, but is it worth it? Is this something that we should start considering, since it doesn't seem like we have any other viable options at this time to keep these cities running?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was kind of a point that was raised in the article, was like, these are supposed to be public services, so why are they being, like, semi-privatized, essentially? But on the other hand,
because the government is failing.
Right. That's the thing. There's a shortage of revenue, especially during the recession. There's a serious shortage of revenue in government. And where is the money currently located in large amounts? Mm-hmm. Very rich people and corporations. Now, in terms of inner cities, probably a lot of these places like Baltimore, there's probably not a huge number of like super rich people that even could be taxed if you found the political will to do it. And so, and the federal, you know, and state budgets are being cut too. So that, you know, financial aid from above that used to happen is no longer happening. So that pretty much just leaves it with the big corporations. I mean, the small businesses and local businesses in some of these places can help out, but a lot of times they're not going to be able to either because they've been negatively affected as well by the recession. So, you know, in terms of major cities, I think this is probably going to have to happen. I think it's really unfortunate, but until these other budgetary sources recover, that's going to be a problem. And, you know, in terms of the bigger picture, I think it ties back to what we've been talking about, this sort of resistance to paying higher income taxes, even on the super wealthy, you know, people's highest tax brackets, you know, resistance to like millionaires' taxes and things like that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a general problem.
Part of me honestly hopes that some of this is going to go through and will be sort of a fairly harmless way to illustrate the problem that we have and to sort of drive the point home that we're privatizing things that need to be never ever privatized, that we don't. These are very dangerous connections, depending on the contracts that these cities sign with their advertisers. How much influence are they going to be able to have over everything that's happening when it comes to cops, when it comes to firefighters, when it comes to the people that are fixing your roads? And something as ridiculous as a KFC, you know, spray-painted over a filled pothole. It's just – that image to me just reminds me of something from, like, Artomatic, something that is just so
– there, you know, other weird examples from the article that there was – there have been multiple subway stops in New York and places like that that have been renamed for corporate things. So, you know, the Atlantic Avenue stop in Brooklyn is now the Barclays Center stop. And there was another one that was like AT&T stop, which is just utterly meaningless. It wasn't like it was even near anything in particular. It was like they just randomly said, okay, such and such station is now the AT&T station and put AT&T logos all over it. And then, you know, took out the original names. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of money that they could probably make, but still, like, that's so absurd.
I agree. It's completely absurd, yeah. And I'm hoping that things that are this sort of explicitly sellout is the way that I want to describe it,
yeah,
will push home the fact that we have a deep problem, and it's not just the fact that we are selling out. It's the fact that we're so desperate that we need to go through these things to pay for very basic things that the city should be able to pay for itself through taxation.
Well, I think that this transitions into the story from France. You know, France has a bit of a reputation, often very misguided in the last few decades in the United States, of being, you know, a very tax and spend borderline socialist state. There's been a lot of discussion about how the Socialist Party in France is essentially basically now the Democratic Party equivalent. It's almost entirely lost its vestiges of actual socialism. Apparently they still call each other comrade at party conferences as kind of a nod to the professors that are still in the party, but that's like about it. They're not really socialistic at all. They're social democrats at best, and kind of there's been this convergence similar to the United States where the lines get a little bit blurred. It's obviously easier to make that blurring happen in France when the parties are already closer together and more moderate anyway. But the two major parties kind of blurred together a little bit. But the Socialist Party, which has taken the French presidency and I believe the National Assembly as well, have announced new taxes on businesses and upper brackets for the wealthy, as well as some one-time taxes on things like oil revenues from the French energy companies that they say have been profiting from the spike in oil and gas prices recently. Mm-hmm. And I thought that this was interesting. It's always a bit of a debate about, you know, or I guess in the United States, it's always a huge debate about mm-hmm. whether or not to increase taxes during a recession, because on the one hand, it provides more revenue so then the government can spend more easily, especially when they're under deficit restrictions like Eurozone countries like France are. Mm-hmm. But it is a problem because it can potentially contract the economy by, you know, that people have less to spend. But the thing is, as I said, this is corporate taxes and taxes on the wealthy. And so those people, especially the taxes on the wealthy, those, you know, they're going to spend basically the same amount regardless. This isn't going to be a huge jump, I don't think. But it's going to generate billions of euros in new revenues for the government. And that's going to make it easier to control the deficit while hopefully spending on programs domestically that will help help people get back to work and that sort of thing. And of course, it's a critical time in the Eurozone in general because of the instability of some of the currencies members and their deficits.
Honestly, anything that has to do with taxation or the economy in general in Western Europe now, I wonder if their decisions aren't just directly based on what's the problems with Greece and other countries like it. There have been so many scares that it just seems like, to me, this article reads as something of France trying to make sure that they don't stumble as well. Not that they're anywhere near that problematic, but depending on what happens with the euro and who has to support who, I would be sort of trying to bolster my country as well.
Yeah, this kind of shores up their reserves governmentally that they can, you know, that they now have more money to pay off some of the debts and they don't have to take out as many new loans and mm-hmm. put themselves potentially at risk if everything sort of starts spiraling. Because, you know, the fear is that if a bunch of the, you know, if Greece and Spain and Italy and Ireland all went down, that a lot of the other countries that are more stable have a lot of
Germany.
Money. They have a lot, like, Germany's probably going to be fine regardless. But
yeah,
but
I mean, Germany's going to be the one pulling them up, probably.
Yeah, but that, but, well, the thing is, Germany's getting pretty resistant to that, too. So then, you know, if they just straight up default, then, you know, countries like France and Britain have loaned them a lot of money. So
yeah.
Then they suddenly don't have that. And then, you know, there's a ripple effect. And I don't think that it's going to get quite that bad. But I can see why they would be kind of wanting to get a handle on the situation and prepare to shut themselves off from the rest of the world if necessary. Not completely, obviously, but just a little bit more
trusting too many people with your dollar.
Exactly.
Or your own, as it were.
But I think though that they were the budget minister said that. He said after the Democratic correction, it was necessary to have a budget correction. The Democratic correction, as the article points out, the New York Times article points out, being the, you know, that they did not reelect for the first time in quite a while the center-right incumbent Sarkozy, and now they have the center-left new president. And so, you know, to some degree, this is still a partisan move. You know, it's certainly not old style red flag waving Marxism or anything by a long shot, but I also think it's interesting that they're able to just, you know, push this right on through, whereas the United States, you know, forget it. So,
oh, goodness, no.
Yeah. So I just thought it would be interesting to, you know, use that as the international story and kind of tie it in with everything else. We have to take a break.
Okay.
Right back for more.
Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy, arming progressives with the phrases and facts to fight back.
Hey, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I'm here with my co-host, Anna, beaming in
Hello.
From the Beltway, as usual.
Can I talk about Illinois?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So you might not know Representative Joe Walsh. He is a Republican from Illinois, and he has very recently made himself incredibly popular by blasting a W amputee's military service. She had the audacity to do two things, one of which was to run against him, and the second of which was to talk about her military service. Now, she went down, I believe, in a helicopter. Yes. And she was in Iraq, I want to say. And let me see. Yep, multiple military awards, including a Purple Heart, an Air Medal, Army Commendation Medal. Basically, this woman is very well-decorated and, as I said, lost both of her legs in the war. And basically, the audacity of this man to silence her is incredible. And he says, let me see if I can pull up the entire thing. And he compares her to John McCain and something that we're going to get into in a second here, but here's the quote. Understand something about John McCain. His political advisors, day after day, had to take him and almost throw him against the wall and hit him against the head and say, Senator, you have to let people know you served. You have to talk about what you did. He didn't want to do it, wouldn't do it. Day after day, they had to convince him. Finally, he talked about it a little bit, but it was very uncomfortable for him. That's what's so noble about our heroes. Now, I want to come back to that, but now I'm running against a woman who, my God, that's all she talks about. Our true heroes, it's the last thing in the world they talk about. That's why we're so indebted and in awe of what they've done. And this is what's wrong with everything about not even military culture, because here's the thing, he never joined the military himself. And to characterize what makes these heroes heroes as not making us uncomfortable by discussing it is incredible. It harks back to, I mean, you think about the people in Vietnam who came back and literally couldn't discuss what had happened. They didn't know how. They had, you know, I'm sure we all have seen something where, you know, it was explained to us what post-traumatic stress syndrome is and having hallucinations that you're back and these things weren't done because they were heroes. It was done because they were heroes who didn't have the resources to discuss what had broken them inside. And so to say that it's not the military service, the fact that she went and fought and the fact that she did so many good things, won all these awards, that would make her good. She would be a real hero if she didn't bother us by discussing it, if she didn't inconvenience us, is absolutely disgusting. And I'm happy to say that there have already been at least one veterans group which has called for his resignation because they agree that what he said was disgusting. He said this in a town hall meeting with several people there. Oh. Yeah, she served for more than 20 years, so this is basically disgusting. Bill, do you want to jump in?
Well, I was just going to say, I think she had run previously. I can't remember if it was against him, but he's been kind of running this smear thing the whole time quietly. This was just when he finally got caught on tape. And, of course, he tried to back out and, like, claim that this was, you know, some slip of the tongue because he's just talking all the time. Talk, 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 talk. And, you know, sometimes...
I can read his digging his heels in quote if you like.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so he was on with, what's her name? Ashley Banfield, who is a CNN anchor. And his response was, and again, I'm quoting, "Oh God, no, Ashley, look, this is what happens when you've got a congressman that's always out in front of people talking." So he starts out, like you say, "Look, at every, you know, these comments were made a week ago at a two-hour town hall with 400 people talking about Obamacare. And like I do at the beginning of every one of my town halls, I introduce the heroes in our presence, the veterans. Look, I'm not going to back down from anything. No, Ashley, this wasn't a slip-up. I don't regret anything I said. Understand me, every man and woman who's worn the uniform is a hero in my book. I've said that thousands of times." So basically, it seems like he's saying, I recognize the people on a regular basis. I say all the time that wearing the hero's uniform is enough, but at the same time, it's absolutely valid for him to crack them down if they have the audacity to be running against him, have opposing viewpoints to him, and basically have the internal fortitude to be able to discuss what happened to them.
Also, if I remember correctly, she was either the secretary or undersecretary of veteran affairs in the first couple years of the Obama administration. So I feel like she's probably dealt with more veterans than he has. Just speculating.
Yeah, and...
And she actually served, as you mentioned.
And she actually served.
Unlike I'm like, Joe, deadbeat dad, Walsh. That's the other thing. I wanted to remind everyone that, let's go there. We should go there. Everyone should always go there. Joe Walsh is known as the deadbeat dad because he's basically lied repeatedly about how much money he was making so that he would get out of paying child support. And this is a well-documented thing you can go look up. It turned out that they figured out that he had more money than he'd said because and was paying a lot less on child support than he should have been because he loaned himself a very large amount of money when he was running in 2010 for the seat. And, you know, the thing is, I just, like, I have this sense from what I've read about him. It just doesn't seem like he has a particularly strong respect for women. And this follow-up interview on CNN just really didn't seem like it was very respectful at all. He kept saying Ashley, which is a little strange, but I guess that's, you know, the first name culture that you have in the media. But it sounded kind of odd. And then at the end he said she was interrupting him too much and called her kiddo, and I just felt like I don't think you would ever call like Wolf Blitzer or Anderson Cooper or John King kiddo. I don't see it. So
I don't know how old Ashley Banfield is, but I'm pretty sure she's not in her like mid-20s. She's not a kiddo in any sense of the word. She's pretty accomplished. I agree with you on all points. And just to get back on my soapbox of mental health, the idea that we should be shaming veterans into being silenced so that they can be proper heroes is really problematic and still something that we struggle with every day.
Yeah. And I was trying to remember earlier, I had mentioned I couldn't remember if she'd run before against him. She didn't run against him, but she was the 2006 nominee in a different district in Illinois before redistricting. And she lost very narrowly there. That was, of course, the big anti-war year. But, it's so absurd. I mean, Joe Walsh has always been seen as a despicable human being who just, you know,
I have no idea why.
He gets very angry at people and that kind of thing, which I feel like if your whole thing is going and meeting with constituents and talking to them constantly, you probably should have a better temper. But whatever. That's just my opinion. It's a pretty disgusting story to say the least. We're going to hit a couple sort of more offbeat stories. The first one from Arizona, why don't you take that, Anna, get us started off on that one.
Arizona Governor Raul Castro, 96, is no longer the governor, but he was for a long time. He was a Democrat. Now he's a 96-year-old man. That's basically what you need to know about him in this. He was detained by agents when he was traveling. They left him in 100-degree heat for more than half an hour because he set off a radiation center at the Border Patrol checkpoint on Interstate 19 north of Tubac. The point is, if you have a pacemaker and you go to the hospital and get things checked out on it, occasionally things like this can trigger off a radiation sensor. These are things that people should know if they are going to hold you in 100-degree weather for half an hour. Let's see, the wife of Mr. Castro said it's traumatic to say the least for an old man. That's kind of an understatement. This is basically one of those common sense issues where, how do I put this? There have been so many TSA stories that are similar to this, of just not using common sense, of not only being aware of basic things that you would need to know medically if you're going to be inspecting people, but also inconveniencing and risking harm to those people because of your ignorance.
Although it would be a heck of a cover to have a 96-year-old man sneaking a dirty bomb into the country.
Oh, I mean, people, they're in the interests of being fair to terrorism, you know, they will often try to use unsuspecting decoys. And they're more likely now to use women, for instance, or very young people, or people that don't, quote-unquote, look foreign, for instance. That being said, even if this is a terrorist 96-year-old man who has slightly triggered off your radiation sensor, he's still a 96-year-old man, and even if he is a terrorist, you still shouldn't leave him in 100-degree weather for half an hour. So I don't think this was even being overly cautious. This was just being ignorant across the board.
Yeah, and they, you know, they had him out in the sun and that kind of thing for most of the time. That's
and if you have
ridiculous.
A pacemaker, let's just say that you're not the fittest, you know, the healthiest to begin with. He was actually very kind about it. He said, once I identified myself who I was, that I had been to the doctor, I was under medical care, I have a pacemaker on my heart. I would have thought that they would have been more considerate and kept and said, keep on going, but that didn't happen. I would have been raising much more of a ruckus over this if I was that old and, you know, inconvenienced.
Yeah. So I wanted to give a little background because you briefly mentioned that he was the former governor of Arizona.
Yes.
And I feel like they should have been able to figure out that, you know, who it was pretty quickly. Maybe they got, you know, a little suspicious because his name was Raul Castro, and that's the same name as the president of Cuba. But this is Raul Hector Castro. He is a well-known Arizonan, even at age 96. Mm-hmm. He was governor for about 3 years in the a little under 3 years in the 1970s. He's really an American dream type guy. When he was about, I think, 10 years old, he immigrated from Mexico to the United States, became a U.S. citizen and so forth, and he really worked so hard to get himself through school, to get a law degree, etc., to make sure that he could pursue his dreams of being in the legal system as a lawyer. And he eventually became a judge, caught the attention of President Lyndon Johnson. He got appointed as the U.S. ambassador to El Salvador.
Then he was
promoted to the U.S. ambassador to Bolivia. And then he left in the first year of the Nixon administration and took a few years off, then became governor of Arizona for a few years until he stepped down early to take an appointment as ambassador to Argentina from President Carter. So, yeah, longtime Democrat, former governor of Arizona, three-time U.S. ambassador, American dream type. He's 96 years old. He's not the president of Cuba. He doesn't have a dirty bomb.
If only we had ever seen photos of the president of Cuba so that we could compare the two. But unfortunately, we only have his name. And so thus, we must be very cautious of Americans driving around in cars.
All right. So I thought that was kind of an offbeat and a little bit sad story. Let's take an offbeat and hilarious and very pathetic story from, where is it, Kentucky?
The
Creationism Museum. Many of you have heard of this. It opened in 2007, much to the shame of all science-loving Americans everywhere. Basically made a laughingstock out of a lot of people.
If you ever want to see a stuffed penguin that's hanging out in a garden with other animals in peace and harmony and no logic, this is the article you should read and see the pictures on.
Yeah, they had a picture this was on Yahoo News. They had a picture of Adam from the Garden of Eden hanging out with a penguin, among other critters. But yeah, in the first year that it was open, and I have to say, I'm sure that a lot of it was curiosity by atheist types and other curious thinking Christians and liberals and various other people who weren't so down with this nonsense. A lot of them probably went in the first year just to see what was going on. They got almost 500,000 people there in admission in the first year. And
Then person had shared all the photos on Facebook, everyone else was like, yeah, I don't need to see that. I've seen stuffed penguins before.
Right. Anyway, but the whole big ridiculous pitch that they've been making the whole time to get kids to come, because you couldn't bring school field trips, which made it hard for a museum to make money, because that's how a lot of museums make a lot of their money. Couldn't bring school field trips because that would be a violation of church and state and be unconstitutional, teaching creationism in public schools. The Supreme Court already ruled on that. They were advertising to kids to, you know, come with their families separately from school by saying that there were dinosaurs there. And of course, these were like people in the same exhibit as dinosaurs. So it's one thing to have like Adam with a penguin. It probably didn't happen that there were penguins with people in the Middle East, but at least there have been people and penguins in the same place at
the
same time.
This was the Garden of Eden. Anything was possible.
But there have not been dinosaurs and people at the same time. That's pretty well established. I understand it's a struggle if you find it hard to believe that 65 million years ago there was a planet at all, let alone the end of the dinosaurs.
And a lot of people don't. At least believe that they never happened at the same time as anything that could even remotely be called a human.
Right, but that doesn't really logically work with the whole six-day creation. I mean, because as the article points out, some Christians believe, a lot of them, especially in the scientific community, believe that, it was maybe six, periods, six epochs, something like that, that it wasn't literally 6 days.
Literally believing it was 6 days is actually a fairly modern thing for Americans, I believe.
Yeah, but...
the point is, hilarious penguins. Go read this article. It's fantastic.
Yeah, but the big issue is that they're really struggling for money. I think that they were going to have this big amusement park type thing. Now it's just kind of downscaled, despite, I think, funding getting approved from the state of Kentucky under the Democratic governor, of all people. They just really want to build an ark. They really, really want to build a full scale replica of the ark.
Please make it happen. And
as some people pointed out, and I think the comments, it's kind of interesting that I think I might have seen this on Google Plus. Somebody was saying it's interesting that Noah, who was supposed to be 600 years old, was able to build it in like a few weeks, and they haven't been able to build it in several years. And they're running out of money. They can't get enough money. It's a bad situation for them. And I think it's hilarious.
I would love to see an ark that only held every single insect that we have. Just the insects, because we are not done discovering them all. You can go to the Amazon and just walk around and discover new things. There are so many things we haven't even figured out yet about our existing insects. Just the bugs. Just fit all the bugs into one boat, two of each, see how that works.
Well, here's my question.
Mammals, reptiles, everything else.
I want to know what would happen if, for budgetary reasons, they had one of each animal. I feel like that cuts their costs by 50%.
What if every single one was pregnant? If it was a female that was pregnant. Or, in the case of seahorses, a male that was pregnant.
That was a very important distinction. Thank you for including the seahorse community. Thanks you. All right.
The point is, you can just cut this anyway and give them as many sort of leeways as possible, and you still can't do it unless you admit that there are more things. Either there are more species than there were then, for reasons that can't be evolution, or it never happened, or the Ark was a TARDIS. I'm just saying.
I think that's a good theory and a good one to end on, because we are out of time for today's show. But thank you for listening to the Arsenal for Democracy on July 5th, 2012. The FM broadcast of this episode airs Friday, July 6th at our summer broadcast time of 4 p.m. Eastern from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark. Tonight's episode will be available for download from iTunes and other locations after the FM broadcast. Our next episode is scheduled to record and live stream next Thursday evening at billhumphreyresearch.com/radio, assuming that the server is back up and running. My co-host tonight via Skype from Northern Virginia has been Anna, a moderator from ONTD Political. From the WVUD studios in Newark, Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.